you know where I could find Chuck?
Chuck Jaffe has been called a lot of things. Senior columnist for MarketWatch.
Yay! I'm a feature columnist!
Professor Stupid for his stupid investment of the week.
I'm impatient with stupidity. My people have learned to live without it.
The world's most widely read observer of the mutual fund industry.
Chuck, I am so proud of you.
And of course, his audience has its own ideas. Both good.
Chuck's a good person.
He's a great man.
Do you realize how much money he just saved us?
You really saved my ass, Chuck.
And bad.
He is a turd sandwich.
What a maroon.
You're such a doofus.
He's a common ignorant slob. He don't even speak good English.
Hey, fat boy! Yeah, I'm talking to you.
But no matter what you say about him, he's an independent thinker who's unafraid to challenge conventional wisdom. Which is why we decided he should be at the controls of his own hour-long weekday radio show.
Okay, but I'm not good at details or the big picture. I also show up late and drunk.
It's smart talk on the pocketbook, portfolio, and personal finance issues that matter the most to you.
Let's talk about something important.
And with a terrific lineup of guests to talk to, even Chuck can't mess it up.
It's not your fault, Chuck.
And now, here's Chuck Jaffe.
Chuck, what are you doing here?
Good morning and welcome to Money Life for April the 14th. I'm Chuck Jaffe, senior columnist for MarketWatch. Hope ready to have a good time today talking personal finance because we are going to do just that. Or at least I'm going to have a good time talking personal finance. I hope you're going to have a good time listening to our talk about personal finance. And let me tell you, we have a tremendous lineup today. So it's Thursday. That means Tom Lydon is in the house, bringing us the ETF of the week. Tom, of course, editor of ETF Trends. You know, if you listened to yesterday's show, that we didn't have the Hightower Gang yesterday. Instead, we had Bob Powell on. The Hightower Gang is here today. So Matthias Coolmay joins us, along with Adam Thurgood from Hightower Las Vegas and Peter Lang from Hightower Westchester. We will be talking emerging markets with them, which will give you an interesting juxtaposition from the interview we had on Monday with Andrew Foster from the Seafair Overseas Growth and Income Fund, right? So you'll go from the fund manager level with what you got from Andrew on Monday, and you'll now get the financial planner level. Sort of one is looking at, hey, what do I invest in because I've got to make money investing in this space? The other is looking at, do I even invest in this space? What do I think of current trends and more? So that's our regulars. Now, between them, Tim Clift joins us today. He is chief investment strategist for InvestNet. He was on a show that we did back, I want to say, it was about our 50th show. It was right near our 50th show. I remember looking to see when I'd had him on last, and it said it was right near our 50th show. Our 50th show would have been in the summer of 2012. I know that we had a point where we had arranged to have Tim on the show, or maybe we had him on the show when we were on the road and doing something at Morningstar or what have you. But he's a very good interview, and we'll be talking with him about sort of market volatility and some of those other things because he brings an interesting take. He looks at managing other managers in many respects. Our Money Life market call today, well, that is David Miller from the Catalyst Funds, and we'll be talking about the insider buying strategy, specifically the Catalyst Insider Buying Fund. So a totally different methodology, sort of akin to the way we had a different methodology with Charlie Clark on Monday from the Takeover Fund, the USA Mutual's Takeover Target Fund. This is a completely different kind of methodology from anything else we do, but it doesn't make it any less interesting. In fact, I think it makes it more interesting. So that is our lineup for today. Now, speaking of our lineup, we had a contest on Tuesday's show. If you could send me requests for guests, if you were the first one to get in with a request for a guest who had never been on the show before. Now, just like I said that Tim Clift was on the show back in 2012, I had to go check because a couple of the names that came out were very, very interesting folks. Now, some of them are people that have been on the show. Like, I'm sorry if you didn't know that Mario Gabelli has been on the show. Well, Mario and I tend to do interviews every year at Morningstar. I've known Mario. He was the very first industry analyst I ever talked to. He was an auto analyst for Pershing and Company when I was a Cub reporter at the Detroit Free Press in the mid-1980s. He was the very first industry analyst I ever talked to. We've actually been friendly ever since, in that every chance I get an opportunity to talk to Mario. He's always happy to see me. He's done a couple of media events that he's asked me to be the MC on. So, yeah, Mario's been on the show. We had some other names that I thought were interesting. So the rule was you had to be one of the first two people to give me a suggestion for somebody who had not been on the show before. Our winners are Chris from Morrisville, North Carolina, who suggested Mitch Eichen, who's from Assertus. I'm hopeful we'll be able to get him. And from Phil in Columbia, Missouri, who asked about Andy Swan from a company called Like Portfolio. Andy will be on in the next couple of weeks. And you only win, Phil, because we hadn't booked Andy by the time you were doing it. The interesting side is the PR person for Andy is somebody that we've worked with before who was going to suggest him and hadn't yet. He and I were talking about other things, and he literally asked me yesterday, hey, would you like to get Andy Swan from Mike Portfolio? And I said, why? Are you repping him? And he said, yep. So that's already arranged. Like Portfolio, Like Folio, you'll find an interesting thing. Some of the other suggestions we got I thought were pretty cool. Meb Faber from Cambria. Meb has been on the show before. I should have him back, but he has been on the show before. Bob Brinker. I don't think Bob Brinker's coming on the show with me. I know that some of you like him, some of you don't. I don't think Bob is coming on the show. He's not actually known for doing interviews with other people. He does his own show and he does his own thing. Years ago, he took me to task for something and thought I guess had taken him to task for something. I don't care. I don't keep score on those things. Couldn't care less. But a couple of you suggested the Shark Tank guys. We have twice tried to have Robert Herjavec on the show, and then they wind up canceling on us last minute. I'm willing to try again, but we have to see. We had requests for people like Robert Gardner from now Grandeur Peaks. Robert has been on the show before. He was on the show before, so thanks for the suggestion. Charles Mizrahi from Hidden Values Alert was suggested. Charles has been on the show, although it's now been a couple of years. The Keeleys, Bernard Keeley, the Keeley Funds. Bernard is not going to do any interviews at all. His sons might. His sons talk to me, but they've never wanted to come on the show. And then, of course, we got a couple of big names. Jeremy Grantham. Now, that is like would be my favorite wish list get, but it's not going to happen. And Bill Gross. And no, I wouldn't, even if Bill Gross, if Bill Gross wanted to be on the show, I would do it. But A, Bill Gross doesn't want to be on the show. And B, well, he's a terrible speaker. If you can keep him tight on a question, you can do okay. But the truth is, Bill tends to go into jargon. I mean, he's a brilliant man, but he tends to sort of, in interviews, get into that brilliance, and it winds up making for a not very good interview. So great suggestions all. Chris from North Carolina, Phil in Columbia, Missouri. Books from Chris Carosa are winding their way to you. For everybody else, thanks for the suggestions. We'll try to get some of these folks on, and that way you win even though you didn't win. I'm Chuck Jaffe, senior columnist for MarketWatch, host of this show every weekday. My columns are online at MarketWatch.com. There's one going up today. You can follow me on Twitter at MKTWJaffe to make sure that you don't miss anything when I'm writing a column. You can also follow the show at Money Life Show on Twitter so that you'll know what we're talking about and hold it or fold it and much, much more. And of course, our website is MoneyLifeShow.com. You can reach me at Chuck@MoneyLifeShow.com. If you got questions, comments, suggestions, and more, tickers for hold it or fold it, we could use some of those too, and a whole lot more. So that's it. We got a great show planned. It's part of what's been a great week and what should continue to be a great week and a great month. So thanks so much for joining me. Let's get busy. Our lineup again, Tom Lydon to Tim Clift to the Hightower Gang, and then David Miller from the Catalyst Funds in for the market call. We'll start things off with the ETF of the week in just a moment.
Looking for alternative ETF strategies? Direction provides separate and distinct audiences with flexible investment tools to manage risk and execute short-term strategies. For more information, go to directionshares.com.
It's ETF of the week time, and that means Tom Lydon joins me now. Tom, of course, is the editor at ETFtrends.com, a site that not only includes his insights into what's going on in the ETF space and what spaces are doing well, what you might want to get more interested in and what you might want to move out of, but it includes everything you need to know about ETF investing, from soup to nuts, what's new, what's different, what's changing, and much, much more. It's ETFTrends.com. They're on Twitter at ETFTrends, and Tom is on Twitter. He is at Tom Lydon. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back, Chuck. Thanks.
Our ETF of the week is
the Goldman Sachs Active Beta Large Cap Equity ETF, ticker symbol GSLC.
Okay, let me say this one again because there's a lot here. It is GSLC, the Goldman Sachs Active Beta U.S. Large Cap Equity ETF. Break this down. There's four potential things that are really important in there. There is Goldman Sachs, the sponsor. There is Active Beta. There is U.S. And there is Large Cap. Which one of those is driving the bus here and making it the ETF of the week?
A couple things, Chuck. We've talked a lot about the term smart beta, and that becomes more and more popular as we see more and more advisors and investors shifting money into not legacy passive index-based ETFs, but more passive ETFs that have a certain factor to them. So it might be volatility, it might be value, it might be dividend-oriented. We're hearing more and more about these types of strategies. What Goldman Sachs has done in one of their first ETFs that they offered, which is this GSLC, picture the S&P 500, picture the expense ratio the same as SPY, the first ETF out, at 9 basis points, because this ETF has exactly the same expense ratio. However, there's a multi-factor approach to this ETF, and the fact that it screens the underlying stocks for price-to-book value, sales-to-price, free cash flow, and also representing undervalued companies relative to the rest of the market. So it's a disciplined kind of active beta strategy within this ETF index compared to the S&P 500, which we know is a cap-weighted legacy index, and over time, the constituents that come in and out of the S&P 500 don't change that often. So if a certain company or even a certain asset class tends to have difficulty over a certain period of time, S&P is not that quick to kick them out. In an active beta strategy, a multi-factor strategy, by putting the underlying constituents or the companies through this rigor, only the better companies come out the back end, and this is done on a regular basis. So here we are in a situation where the ETF industry continues to evolve. Yes, S&P 500 is a benchmark. You want to make sure that you have a certain percentage of your portfolio earmarked towards the S&P 500. But here's a way to have, at the same price, 9 basis points, kind of an active beta strategy that may be, let's say, energy-based companies with the decline in oil are having declining revenues and maybe even some credit issues. Those types of companies may not be within the underlying index. So it's, to a degree, not active management, but kind of active beta strategy where it weeds out some of the worst performers of the S&P 500 over a regular period of time.
So we like that. We like the ability to move there. The question is, does this then supplement what you've got, or does it replace what you've got so that somebody who's looking out there goes, I already have some exposure. But as you pointed out, this is a different way to get that exposure. It's a more actively passive way, right? It's more passive. It's more actively passive, not more passively active. Whereas maybe it's both. The problem with smart beta is that's what we're talking about, is I'll be more active in how I'm passive, or I'll be more passive in how I'm active. But when you look at it, where is this money coming from? And is this just a case of, I want to make sure that my money is exposed to the index, but different ways of indexing?
So we have talked before about portfolio construction, and the average investor out there, if they were to go to Morningstar.com, for example, plug in your whole portfolio, there are many individual investors that would find that a majority of their portfolio is tied from a correlation standpoint to the S&P 500. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but if you've got multiple mutual funds that are actively managed and you're paying a high expense ratio and you're underperforming the S&P, That may not make sense today. On top of that, as we've talked in many months, there are a lot of turnover going on in these actively managed mutual funds that even during flat years or down years, these mutual funds can kick off some pretty lofty year-end dividends, which doesn't help at this time of year from a tax standpoint. So look at it this way. Look at your mutual funds, understand the expenses, understand the dividends that are kicked off every year. If you want to diversify away from those types of strategies where you're paying a lot less, that makes a heck of a lot of sense. Not dumping your S&P 500 ETF for sure, but maybe your mutual funds that aren't as tax efficient as this ETF and also that have kind of an active strategy.
And is this core holding, you're going to keep this because it does all those things, or is this 200-day moving average play?
I think from this standpoint, where a lot of people are holding this for an extended period of time or holding the S&P 500 or like mutual funds for an extended period of time, anything that you have correlated the S&P 500, take 10% of it and put it into GSLC. I think you'll do a few things. Better tax efficiency, lower expenses, and in fact, since this has been out there, it's outperformed the S&P 500. I don't think you can go wrong.
That means it's a core holding. That's what we're saying here is we're taking part of our S&P basic portfolio and making this a core holding that we're going to hold in good times and bad.
That's right.
There you go. It's the Goldman Sachs Active Beta U.S. Large Cap Equity ETF, GSLC, a core holding that is going to diversify some of your core holdings. For more information, go to ETFtrends.com on Twitter at ETFtrends. Tom is on Twitter. He's at Tom Lydon. Tom, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks, Chuck.
The big interview is next. Tim Clift from InvestNet will be here when Money Life continues in just a moment.
At Hightower, providing the best fiduciary advice to every advisory client is not just a job. It's a legal duty. Sophisticated asset management, lifetime financial planning, and wealth management solutions. At Hightower, it all adds up to peace of mind. Visit HightowerAdvisors.com to learn more about the Hightower difference.
Time to get ready.
Of course. Ready for what?
It's the big interview. Thinking big, living big, talking big with market strategists, money managers, economists, authors, and more.
Get ready to feel the thunder.
Long chats with big brains meant to give you a better view of the big picture.
As far as brains go, I got the lion's share.
As Money Life goes big time.
Big reason for this success is you.
Literally.
It's big interview time here on Money Life, and I'm pleased to be joined right now by Tim Clift, the Chief Investment Strategist at InvestNet. If you are not familiar with the firm, well, you can go to investpmc.com, the website. You can follow them on Twitter. They're at ENV Intel. And Tim Clift is on Twitter. He's at ENV for InvestNet. He's at ENV Clift. But right now, he's back on Money Life. And by the way, he was last here like 3 or 4 years ago. So he was an early guest on Money Life. I don't really know why we didn't have him back sooner, but I'm pleased to say, Tim Clift, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Chuck, for having me back. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been. But the great thing is that the stock market always allows us to just sort of pick up on a new conversation. Like, you could be gone for a week, a month, a year, 5 years, and it doesn't necessarily make a difference because the market's always giving us plenty to talk about. And in this case, you know, you run a group of analysts who look at selecting investment managers and what have you. So let's start with what we're seeing out of the market in terms of volatility and how that is shaping what people should be considering right now. Because we've got a market where at least the volatility seems heightened, but it also seems like we've now lived through enough heightened volatility that we should just be adjusting to the fact that this isn't heightened. This is normal. This is whatever we're going to see probably in perpetuity. Or am I wrong about that? Is this actually heightened volatility and we're going back to something better someday?
I think we're in it for a while. You know, we saw it in the first quarter where we had a big V-shape, you know, drop into February and then a big rebound again. And we're talking double digits. So, you know, full correction and then back out again. We saw the same thing last August to October. So I don't think it's it's anything that's going to go away, you know, with the political elections coming up, with oil prices changing, the dollar, you know, falling and rising, all those things are going to have big impact on the markets, and I just don't see it fading away at all.
You mentioned politics, and I don't want to talk politics per se, but I'm curious when you talk about the volatility. This election seems to have had less impact thus far than I would have expected. You have a political situation unlike pretty much anything most of us have seen in our lifetimes. Normally, the market is trying to figure out what's going to happen and pricing those things in. And in this case, I can't tell, but it looks to me like the market is as confused as the general populace as to just how this thing might turn out, and they don't want to actually wager on any of it. Or am I wrong about that? Are they starting to say, hey, these are the outcomes we see?
I think investors are actually getting smarter in figuring out that the elections don't matter as much to the overall markets. I think right now they are kind of pricing in a Clinton win. That's kind of from a statistics standpoint. And if that does happen, that's probably the least surprises that will be expected because it's an administration that's already in-house. The other candidates would be much more wild cards. And I think as we get closer, you may see that, again, that volatility spike up a little bit more. But again, I think investors have kind of figured out that even whoever's in the White House, there's lots of good checks and balances that go on so that they just can't come in and turn everything around or make huge dramatic changes all of a sudden. So there's some comfort from an investor standpoint and the market standpoint that's probably not going to happen, that it's more headline news than is actually going to affect the market.
Yeah, although certain candidates are suggesting they can come in and do just about anything and turn the market on its ear. We'll move away from politics and let's go back to the volatility side and put it in the context of the active versus passive debate. We've got a situation where right now the passive funds are creating the buzz. It's what people want to own. They've come to the conclusion that I'm better off owning the index or what have you, or I'm better off owning smart beta index or something that's created that keeps me low costs and does whatever. And yet, all they're really doing in many cases is transferring where the action is. In other words, hey, I'm working with a financial advisor. That person is buying passive investments. So I can say I've got the passive investments. But then that person is actively managing those passive investments. What's the better model here? Are we better off saying, hey, I'll be actively passive, which is that case where you're hiring a money manager, they put you into passive funds, but they manage them? Or are we better off being actively active? Let me just go find old-fashioned fund managers. Or passive. Here's my asset allocation. I'm going to go on the benchmarks, and that's it.
Yeah, I think we're seeing active and passive converge. So from a product standpoint, we're seeing the active managers moving into vehicles that are more passive-like. And we're seeing, you know, active ETFs, for example. And on the passive side, we're seeing, you know, more expensive passive products like the smart beta that you talked about. So there's really convergence. And I think eventually we're going to get to one type of product, the kind of lower cost, but that can use active or passive within it. You're right about there being a lot of strategies or managers out there that are using ETFs as the underlying investment vehicle because it is very inexpensive. And I think that's generally a smart thing to do. And they can overlay their thoughts and, you know, kind of where they think the markets are going to go. But I also don't think that we should completely give up on active. I think there's still areas, even though in the first quarter, active really got trounced in general. But if you look at the low cost active managers, and if you looked at some of the less efficient market classes, like small cap, for example, they actually did very well. And they traditionally do very well. So it's good to understand, you know, when to use active. You know, I don't think an all active strategy is necessarily always the best route. But it also depends on market conditions. If correlations are high or low or volatility is high or low, those different market environments can have a very different impact on active managers versus passive managers. So I know I'm not answering yes or no or all
no,
active or all passive.
You're not.
Yeah.
But you raised an interesting issue, which is most of the logic that has gone into people saying, oh, I should be passive has been how the numbers get played. And I wrote about this recently, and you mentioned, well, you haven't necessarily seen the active managers doing great. But if you took the low-cost active managers, they as a group have done better. And in fact, there have been a couple of studies recently that came out and said, look, you can find active management that works. You're never going to get overcome the numbers, but that's because when you put in the average fund, well, the average fund includes a whole bunch of funds that they're actively managed, but they're not keeping their expense ratios down. They're not doing any of the other right things. Do you believe that the case against active management is basically overblown by sort of self-interested folks and the goofiness of the numbers?
I do in general, yes. I really think the argument is not active versus passive, but it's high cost versus low cost. So if you can have low cost active and low cost passive, I think that's much better comparisons that you can make. So I think both the active managers and the passive managers are going to come out with studies that are going to be proponents of their type of strategy. But when we look at it, we are very unbiased. We're just, you know, we're going to say, well, you know, in this market environment, active is better, or in these asset classes, active or passive is better. And I think that's a much better way to construct a portfolio.
When people think about the whole active versus passive debate, we now create these smart beta and other tools. Are we creating the proverbial better mousetrap and it really is a better mousetrap? Or are we creating a different mousetrap and that allows you to then look at it differently, market it differently, and do those other things? Because I have a hard time looking at this with like my kids who are in their early 20s and are starting investors right now. For them, buying the legacy index funds still makes sense. But I'm being told, oh, there's this product and it's better, or this is a better constructed index. And I'm sure that by the time I have grandkids and I'm trying to teach them about investing, there will be something else that is newfangled and different. How much can people rely on the legacy products and have them be okay? Whereas, oh, by the way, if you managed a pension fund or something in an endowment or something like that, then maybe you need to go all the way to some new whole hog thing because every little last basis point counts.
Yeah, I think we're getting into product confusion within ETFs. It used to be really simple when they started back in the 90s, and it was just the broad indexes that they were tracking, and they were low cost. Now there's over 2,000 ETFs, and I just saw one firm out there launching a whole series of healthcare ETFs, and one is focused on obesity, and one is on fitness, and one is on long-term care. Yeah, so these things are getting so niche-y that I'm just not sure you're going to get a whole lot of diversification because you may not have a whole lot of holdings that actually track to those things. And I don't know how viable they are because we see a lot of these small ones that maybe don't catch on and then get closed down. So I think there's buzz originally, and then depending on the cost and the traction, they either last or they don't last. I don't think newer is always better. I think there's a lot of, with these smart beta, you know, they've got great historical track records that are back tested, but not maybe a lot of experience yet. So, you know, I am very cautious when I'm looking at these. I like to see how they perform for a while and see if they're the real thing. And, you know, there's a few factors that have been proven over a long time, like momentum and value, but there's other ones that, you know, again, I'd be hesitant about jumping into, and probably the old stuff is still just as good.
Well, Tim, I appreciate the perspective. I wish I had more time because I have more questions. So promise me you won't stay away a couple of years before we get you back on the show.
I'd love to come back another time, Chuck.
Thanks very much. Tim Clift is Chief Investment Strategist for InvestNet. He's on Twitter at ENVClift. And the firm, it's online at investpmc.com. Hey, we just hit the halfway poll on the April 14th edition of Money Life. Up next, Collective Wisdom from Hightower Global Investment Solutions, and then the Money Life Market Call. Stay tuned.
Customize an investment portfolio with FlexShares, ETFs designed to pursue targeted goals and to adapt to changing market conditions with both equity and fixed income solutions. For more information, go to FlexShares.com.
When it comes to investing and managing money, there is no one right way.
Of course, people do go both ways.
Ultimately, you and your advisors will make shared decisions to determine the path you take.
It appears we share the same passions.
Welcome to Collective Wisdom from Hightower's Global Investment Solutions, where Hightower advisors look at key situations facing you and help you see how discussion and analysis can lead to ideal decisions. Yes, it's time to get smart and put our heads together. And make the best decision for your situation.
And now it's time for collective wisdom from Hightower's Global Investment Solutions. This is a segment that is particularly interesting here on Money Life because it brings you multiple opinions, but those multiple opinions come from the same firm. Unlike many firms, Hightower Advisors doesn't require the people who come to work for it to swallow the house thinking and drink the house Kool-Aid. Instead, everybody gets to bring their own flavors here. Hightower works with experienced advisors, lets them bring their experience, their positioning, their attitude, and what has worked for them to the mix. It then encourages them to work and bounce those ideas off of each other to make sure that clients get the best from their advisor. If you want to learn more about the Hightower difference, go to HightowerAdvisors.com. They're on Twitter at Hightower, A-D-V-S-O-R. Hightower is a sponsor of the show. Joining me now, Matthias Kuhlme, Managing Director and Partner at Hightower's Global Investment Solutions, on Twitter at MoneyClipBlog. Adam Thurgood, Managing Director and Partner with Hightower Las Vegas, on Twitter at @AT_AdamThurgood. And Peter Lang, Managing Director and Partner at Hightower Westchester, on Twitter at Hightower West CH. Matthias, we will start with you, and we are talking about emerging markets. And of late, there's been a lot more to talk about because emerging markets have had a little bounce back, a little recovery. The question is, what do you see happening next? Is this something exciting to you and maybe you should be playing it? Or is this something that is interesting, but maybe not worth getting involved in?
Well, Chuck, allow me to lead with a conclusion first. Well, maybe not quite yet, because last year we recorded a segment, and I think this is the beauty of Hightower's collective wisdom. Through our argument and discovery, we actually found that emerging markets are quite a good deal, and this was last year. Now in the short term, and this was your question for today's segment, the uptrend in emerging markets is likely challenged, as some of the unique factors that have contributed to the recent rally are fading. So let me explain. The first thing is the recovery of oil was very important, and then a weaker dollar have been really the main drivers, not only behind emerging markets, but really behind all risk assets that we have seen. At the same time, and this is something we can never forget, global economic growth is further cooling, and it's now an estimated 3.2% for 2016. Not a great number. And, you know, quite frankly, one good number that came out of China in the last couple of days is not enough for me to at least change my opinion on the trend overall. Second, we're entering the U.S. earnings season, which in my view is flawed to begin with. We have talked about this in previous segments because expectations are really managed to the downside. That said, if U.S. markets based on earnings can continue to lead the way, the negative impact on emerging market equities especially may be muted. So, in conclusion, in the short term, stay cautious, take some gains if emerging markets were tactical or even a trading position. In the long term, and I think we talk about this next week in the segment, embrace select emerging markets. They are great value play at current levels.
Let's turn this over to Adam Thurgood from Hightower Las Vegas. Adam, Matthias talked about how a lot of folks are trying to mute the expectations on emerging markets. But again, we've had this recent rally. To you, is it, yes, mute it, keep it calm and don't get too excited? We've seen this before. Or is it something that on the short term you think is sustainable and worth looking at?
I think the answer is it depends. And I know I've given that answer plenty of times in the past. But the emerging market space is very diverse. There are a lot of different types of countries and companies that make up EM. So I think you have to be a bit more selective when you're looking at what could do well and what might pull back. As Matthias said, global growth is slowing. Emerging markets have been a huge beneficiary of China's investment in infrastructure over the past 10 or 15 years. And so that process is now being reversed. China is not spending nearly as much money on building out their infrastructure. And as a result, the commodity-driven emerging markets are likely to suffer. And you look at a place like Brazil, which the ETF for Brazil is up over 30% so far this year. Some of that's currency, some of that is price appreciation. But Brazil is a very challenged market because of their dependence on China and their political structure. So I think that's an area that you might want to fade the rally on because it doesn't look that good from a structural perspective. Mm-hmm. But on the flip side, consumption-driven EM looks quite quite good. The consumer in the emerging market is becoming more healthy. There's a growing middle class in places like India that can support further consumption. So I really believe that the way to play emerging markets is to get exposure to the consumer and not the commodity producer. On a big picture level, the PE ratio for emerging markets is about at its long-term average versus the S&P, which is about 2.5 points above average. So if you want to take a big picture view of EM, it certainly looks cheaper than the S&P on a relative basis.
Very interesting. And now I'll use that to springboard into Peter Lang from Hightower Westchester. Peter, the interesting side of that comment was that Adam is talking about the consumer driving the interest in the emerging market. And that is a long-term trend. And the short-term recovery that we've seen has been driven, if anything, by more of the commodity stuff that he talked about not liking. So is the short-term story one that you dislike and the long-term story one that you like? Or, hey, you got a strong rally here. Short-term's okay.
I would go with the latter. I think the short term is okay. I'm not necessarily excited about adding more money. I agree with what Adam said about the consumer, about wanting to get more exposure to the consumer-oriented as they gather wealth and develop wealth and move into the middle class. But on the commodity segment, actually, I find the commodity area pretty interesting. You know, alluding to what Mattias said, we obviously had a very volatile first 3-4 months of the year, plus the end of last year with oil in particular, and oil dragged down all the other commodities. But we've seen a pretty strong bounce in oil and a lot of other commodities. And commodities are big in the emerging markets. That's where a lot of the stuff is mined and the raw materials are shipped out to other places like China, like Brazil, like other places that are then doing something with the raw materials. So I think the commodity bounce will actually be helpful in both. I think commodities are interesting in and of themselves. And the fact that there's been a commodity bounce will actually help the consumers in those emerging economies, because it's going to put some more money on their table to spend and to grow with.
Well, gentlemen, really interesting perspective. And as Mattias referenced, we're going to come back next week and follow up on this discussion to take it a step further and talk a little bit more about how you might be using emerging markets in your client portfolios. This has been Collective Wisdom from Hightower's Global Investment Solutions. And if you want more information on Hightower and the Hightower difference, go to HightowerAdvisors.com. My guests have been Mattias Kuhlme, Head of Global Investment Solutions for Hightower, Adam Thurgood from Hightower Las Vegas, and Peter Lang from Hightower Westchester. Get your pens out for Twitter handles. For Hightower Advisors, it's at Hightower ADVSOR. For Mattias, at MoneyClip Blog. For Adam, at @AT_AdamThurgood. And for Peter, at Hightower West CH. We will be back with the Money Life Market Call when the April 14th edition of Money Life continues right after this message.
Independent and advisor-owned, Hightower ensures that best-in-class financial product and service providers compete for your business every day, a groundbreaking model that's making waves on Wall Street. Discover what Hightower can do for you at HightowerAdvisors.com.
Are you playing the market, or is the market playing you?
You done taken a wrong turn.
The Money Life Market Call helps you answer the question by discussing what's working in the investment world right now.
It's working. It's working. It's working.
It's real guidance about real investments from real experts.
I play at expert level.
You might find that next great investment you were looking for, or hear that it's time to sell something you expected to hold on to.
Let it go.
You'll learn how investment pros make decisions and what they see for the future.
See your future. Be your future.
You may be excited one moment and angry or frustrated the next.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
But that's just life in the market, as Chuck Jaffe talks stocks, mutual funds, and more.
I can live with that.
In the daily Money Life Market Call.
It's Money Life Market Call time, and you're in for a treat today because my guest is David Miller. He is the co-founder of the Catalyst Mutual Funds. That means the Catalyst Insider Buying Fund. And some other ones. They've got the Catalyst Small Cap Insider Buying Fund. And it's a group of funds that basically are built around very specific strategies. Insider buying being one, buybacks being a different one, etc. If you want to learn more about the funds, catalystmutualfunds.com. Ticker symbol for the Catalyst Insider Buying Fund is INSAX. David Miller, welcome back to Money Life.
It's good to be here.
So the name says one thing. It says insider buying, and that may give a hint as to what it is that you do. But my audience needs to understand methodology and how you decide what you're looking for and how you decide what you're getting away from. And particularly when we're talking catalyst, because you are looking for very specific catalysts.
That's right. So what we're looking for specifically is not just insider buying, but many aspects of insider buying. We're looking for how many insiders are buying or selling a stock, how many shares they're purchasing or selling, how well that insider has timed their previous purchases and sales of that stock in the past, and how highly ranked that particular executive is at the firm. Naturally, a CEO or CFO or COO is going to be privy to more information than a lower level VP might be. And then we take all of that data and then rank every company that we evaluate in real time from a 10 down to a 1 based on how many insiders are buying that stock, how many shares they're purchasing, and all those criteria I'd mentioned to determine whether or not we want to own that stock, hold it, or be short.
Is the process completely quantitative? I mean, you talk about what you are doing and how you do it. Is it a quantitative process based on, hey, we get the filings and we see who's buying and selling and what they're doing? Or is it a little bit of art with science here?
So it's a little bit of both. The key for us is we want to be owning companies that have very extreme insider buying. However, we want to make sure we're eliminating the stories where it's a little bit of window dressing. So, for example, if you see that a new executive just joined the company and they bought $1 million worth of stock and they're required as CEO of the firm, for example, to own $1 million worth of stock, we're going to exclude that company from our criteria. So the first step is really a science. The second step is to decide whether or not we should accept the data that's coming to us based upon what we've seen historically has been strong or weak signals. So, for example, that's been a weak signal if the person just joined the board or just joined the company and bought because they had to. Or, for example, if you see insiders selling, but they're selling while exercising their stock options, that's usually more compensation-driven. So part of it's an art, part of it's a science.
An interesting side for my audience should be that, look, when you're looking at insider buying and selling, it really doesn't seem to have a whole lot of relation to, like, oh, you know, there's a problem with the energy sector or what have you. It doesn't seem to necessarily be something that would drive you to certain sectors. Is that what you find, or is that me thinking intuitively and no, in practice, you actually get to a spot where when a business gets frothy, there's lots of insider movement, and that draws you or pushes you to one thing or another based on economic conditions?
Yeah, so it really goes both ways. For example, if you look at the technology industry, there may be one company in the tech sector in software that has some pretty significant insider buying that we're happy to go out there and start buying, but another company in that very same sector may be having heavy selling because the executives see that their product's not taking off. In that sense, we're sector agnostic. But in another sense, the insiders themselves tend to move in trends as to how their industry is trending. So, for example, if you look at tech stocks in 2000 at the peak before everything blew up, you didn't see a whole lot of executives buying companies at absurd valuations. Similarly, you didn't see a whole lot of executives in financial companies, especially the mortgage firms, buying in late 2007, right before their firms really hit the skids. So we've definitely found that there's some of both. Sometimes you can get great buy and sell signals in the very same industry, but there definitely are industry trends when there's something very significant affecting an industry overall.
So let's talk about what makes it through the process right now and looks good to you. What's a name or two that stands out?
Yeah, so some good examples of stocks that we own right now are companies like First Data or Air Products. If you look at those stocks, they're well-positioned businesses, defensive businesses that have a pretty strong moat. A company like First Data has a pretty strong history overall in terms of their revenue and earnings growth. But when you look at their insider activity, there's good reason to buy in because you see the CEO of the firm, Frank Bisignano, He just bought $1.2 million worth of stock. Another top executive at the firm, Michael Neborak, he just did another large buy on top of that as well in the past couple months. And what we've seen historically is the insiders at that firm have opportunistically timed purchases and sales in the past. Another good example of a company that we like to own right now is Air Products, APD. And if you took a look at APD and the insider activity at APD, they're in the industrial gas business, and the CEO of their company is taking some very significant money out of his own pocket to buy more stock. Seifi Ghasemi just did a $6.3 million purchase of APD stock, and a little while prior to that, he had done a $2.8 million purchase. We see a few other executives at the firm, like John Stanley, buying. Corning Painter's been buying that stock as well, and a director, Charles Cocut, has been purchasing their stock. When you see a lot of executives taking a lot of money out of their own pocket to buy in a similar period, that's usually a pretty good signal for the belief of these executives as to where their business is headed in the near future.
That gives us a couple examples on the good side. First Data, FTC, you all mentioned the ticker symbol on Air Products, APD. What about stuff that you're moving away from?
Yeah, so there's been some difficulty recently in certain stocks in the biotech sector. A good example of that would be Novavax. Novavax insiders had timed that stock very well in the past. There had been big buying back in 2011 when the stock was trading around $1 a share, and they kept buying that stock in a big way. Several executives at the firm, up until the point that it hit around $4.50 to $5 a share, at which point everything really started to shift, and the top executives at that firm started to sell once the firm started hitting new highs. The stock's been on a steady decline since then, and the top executives have been selling along with that decline. When you see weakness in the stock price, and rather than buying into that weakness, the top executives, especially the CEO, like Stanley Erick, are selling into that weakness, that's usually a pretty bad signal for the company in the near term. Another good example would be Adobe, ADBE. There's been a cluster of insider selling by top executives, including the CEO, a director, co-chairman of the board, their CMO. A lot of these executives have been selling into what seems to be a relatively full valuation, not to the same degree as we've seen in something like a Novavax, but when you look at historical earnings, that it's at 75 times earnings, and the executives are selling in a big way into that, that's usually not a very good signal for the stock in the near term.
Okay. Now, I'm curious. You know, you talk about the data that's there and the compelling case that the buying action can make. Do you ever get to a spot where you look at somebody's corporate action and you go, I don't just want to avoid this company, you know, I want to aggressively bet against it and sell it short? Or does insider buying and selling not get you to where you're willing to make that sort of leveraged wager against a firm?
So we use multiple criteria when making our positions on a firm. The most important to us by far is that score rank that we use that ranks every firm from a 10 down to a 1 based on how many insiders are buying and or selling. But then we also put all of our stocks through a quantitative ranking criteria that ranks the firm based on their recent sales growth, their recent earnings growth, their valuation in terms of price to book or price to earnings, what other smart money has been doing in that stock in terms of activist investors or hedge funds. And then we compare their free cash flow versus their net income that they're reporting. So, for example, if you see a company like an Enron back in 2001, and they're reporting a lot of income, but if you look at their cash flow statement and you see they're not generating any cash, a lot of times it means they're playing accounting games to get there. So what we're really looking for is corroborating signals. We want to buy those companies that are ranking well according to our insider buying system, that are also ranking well based on our quantitative criteria. And then, for example, like in our long-short fund, we'd want to sell short the companies that are ranking poorly based upon significant insider selling that are also ranking poorly based on their recent price action, weak earnings or negative earnings, loss in sales or missed earnings reports or departures of CFO or weak cash flow versus reported earnings. So we use all of this data holistically to make a decision on a stock.
Well, now we're going to put you to the test of our audience because it's time for Hold It or Fold It.
Play Hold It.
You got to know when to hold up.
Or Fold It.
Know when to fold up.
It's Hold It or Fold It time with my guest, David Miller, co-founder of the Catalyst Mutual Funds, manager of the Catalyst Insider Buying Fund, INSAX. For more information, go to catalystmutualfunds.com. You know how Hold It or Fold It works. If you want to participate directly, don't forget, just send me your name, your hometown, and the ticker symbols you're interested in. Do that to chuck@moneylifeshow.com. We're going to start with a request we got from Joe in Colorado Springs for Hess Corporation. That's ticker symbol H-E-S.
Absolutely. So on Hess stock, we're getting a 10 signal in our insider buying system from that due to significant insider buying at the company by David McManus, a director there, John Mullen, Kevin Myers, a director. So several executives buying into the stock in a big way. And the oil and gas business has taken a significant hit. So when you see that there's some real recovery to the commodity and the executives are buying into improving fundamentals, that's usually a pretty strong signal for a recovery. We like it.
That's a buy on Hess Corporation, H-E-S. Joe in Colorado Springs had another request, this for ArcelorMittal. That's an ADR trading under MT.
So ArcelorMittal is an ADR, so we don't get the same level of criteria in terms of what we can see that the insiders are doing. However, in our quantitative criteria, ArcelorMittal has not had a very strong Sharpe ratio or risk-adjusted return over time. Their industry has been very cyclical. That's ranked as a hold right now, as the stock's not terribly expensive, but we don't really like the industry.
So that's a hold. You don't really like the industry would suggest it might be a sell, but given the system, it's a hold on ArcelorMittal, ticker symbol MT. Mark in Mitchell, South Dakota, wants to know about Advanced Micro Devices, AMD.
We are ranking AMD as a sell at this particular time, given the selling by several top executives there, including the CFO, Devinder Kumar. When you see the CFO of the firm doing some selling, that's usually not a very good sign. That selling also wasn't terribly recent, but we haven't seen the fundamentals in that industry through our quantitative signals indicating a buy. So that firm is now a sell in our system.
So a sell on Advanced Micro Devices, AMD. John in Seattle wants to know about IDT Corporation, ticker symbol IDT.
IDT has been having some struggles for a long time now. The firm is really kind of going through a long-term weak transition. They haven't really recovered their old glory. There's been significant cluster selling by top executives at the firm, including Joyce Mason, an EVP, Bill Pereira, their CEO, their CAO and controller have all been selling relatively recently. So we are ranking IDT a sell.
So another sell, this time on IDT Corporation, ticker symbol IDT. And last, for Walt in Greenville, South Carolina, it's Invesco Mortgage Capital. That's IVR.
IVR has been very well ranked in our system. Most recently, Richard King, the CEO of that firm, has been buying in a big way, a cluster of insider buying by not just Richard King, their CEO, but Richard Flegley, their CFO, and their chief operating officer, Robson Custer. They've all been buying in a big way with their own personal money. Stock is throwing off a significant yield. We rank IVR Invesco Mortgage Capital as a buy.
So a good buy to end it on, Invesco Mortgage Capital, IVR, is a buy. And speaking of goodbyes, the time has come for us to say our goodbyes to David Miller, co-founder of the Catalyst Mutual Funds, manager of the Catalyst Insider Buying Fund, INSAX, the ticker symbol there. If you want more information, go to catalystmutualfunds.com. David, thanks so much for joining me on the show. Look forward to doing this with you again soon.
Thanks for having me on. Enjoyed it.
We have just about come to the end of our day here on Money Life, but just about means not quite. Let's cross the finish line together. We'll do that right after this message.
PowerShares provides a different take on traditional asset categories while providing advisors and investors with innovative investment opportunities. For more information, go to PowerShares.com. Invesco Distributors Incorporated.
Well, that was a very different approach to investing that you heard about from David Miller. We didn't really have any names there that he had covered, that we had covered on the show previously, although, at least not in Hold It or Fold It. We've covered Air Products and Chemicals a few times. The last time there was with Malcolm Polly, who liked the stock. Air Products rings a bell with me because it's based basically in Fogelsville, Pennsylvania, and it's right in the area where the morning call is, the Morning Call being the newspaper that I was business editor of for 6 years at one point. So the Morning Call near and dear to my life. But and I used to play tennis with the former chairman of Air Products and Chemicals and had to cover that company closely. Never bought the stock. Kind of wish I had, though. But that was a buy the last time it was on. Nothing else has had any sort of crossover. Tomorrow on this show, Troy Harmon from Hensler Equity will be with us. He will be our big interview, or he will be our market call guest. So that is definitely part of the plan. And then Sam Stewart, the president of the Wasatch Funds, the founder of Wasatch Advisors, a fabulous interview. It's kind of like wind him up and let him go. And it's been a couple of years since he's been on the show. I hope we don't let that happen again either. I mean, Tim Cliff today was a nice comeback. I think Sam Stewart tomorrow is an even better comeback. No offense to Tim, but sorry. I think the world of Sam Stewart. He's a classic smart investor who always has articulated it well and has a fund company that does great. So that's tomorrow. I hope you will plan to be here. I want to thank my guests from today. Of course, Tom Lydon, the Hightower Gang, Matthias Kuhlme, Adam Thurgood, and Peter Lang. Tim Clift back after 4+ years, or maybe not quite plus, 4 years roughly, since he was last on the show, and David Miller from the Catalyst Funds. I want to thank Rob Floyd, my producer, and I want to thank you, because you're the ones who make it worthwhile. Plan to be here tomorrow. I'll be here, and I promise you, we will make it worth your time. All right, today's Money Life quote of the day comes from Noel Coward, who said, "I have always paid income tax. I object only when it reaches a stage when I am threatened with having nothing left for my old age, which is due to start next Tuesday or Wednesday." Yeah, well, thankfully for the rest of us, next Tuesday or Wednesday, we don't want to have to worry about our taxes anymore for this year. So that'll make us at least feel better. It may also make us feel older. But I hope no matter how it makes you feel that you'll remember that until we do this again the next time, the best thing you can do for your money is to not worry too much about it. Have a great day, everybody. We will see you tomorrow.
This show is an informational service only. The information provided herein is not to be construed as an offer to buy or sell securities of any kind, and not to be considered a recommendation to buy any stock, but an information resource to aid the investor in making an informed decision. All listeners should consult a qualified professional before trading in any security or pursuing any financial or tax strategy. The information provided has been obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable, but is not guaranteed as to its accuracy or completeness.